Office of Staff Mark Milley has brazenly said American troops will remain in the country for the foreseeable future. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, American troops' illegal presence in Syria will continue. General Mark Milley, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, has predicted. The top general claimed that the military contingent will remain in the country to fight the remaining ISIS militants. President Bashar al-Assad's government has repeatedly demanded that Washington pull out its forces from its territory, describing the U.S. military presence there as illegal. Speaking to Jordan's Al-Mamlaka TV channel recently, Milley said, "I can't imagine that the United States would ever walk away from the Middle East. I think we will remain committed for many, many years and decades to come." The general went on to explain that small groups of ISIS militants remain in and around Syria and around Iraq, and if we were to somehow suddenly withdraw, those forces could reconstruct themselves. When asked whether Washington will leave Syria when the terrorist group has been completely eradicated, Milley said that such a decision would fall to U.S. President Joe Biden. The chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff noted at the same time that the West Asia region as a whole is very significant to the United States for a lot of reasons, not least because it is a primary source of oil and energy resources. Back in July, the Associated Press, citing an anonymous Pentagon official, reported that the U.S. regime was considering a military response to an alleged increasing Russian presence in the skies over Syria. Earlier that month, U.S. Air Force's Central Command, Lieutenant General Alex Gringewich, baselessly claimed that Russian fighter jets had harassed American MQ-9 Reaper drones over Syria on three separate occasions in a week. This is while Syrian President Bashar al-Assad invited the Russian military to assist his forces in the fight against Daesh back in 2015, with Moscow maintaining a military presence in the country ever since. Damascus has repeatedly accused the U.S. regime of shipping stolen Syrian oil out of the country under the guise of an anti-terrorism operation. According to the Syrian government, as much as 80% of the country's daily oil output is taken abroad by U.S. forces and their supported armed groups. According to Tasnim News Agency, Iran has reiterated support for the Syrian government's demand for the complete withdrawal of all illegal foreign military forces from the war-torn country. Addressing a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in Syria recently, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, Amir Saeed Iravani, argued that the illegal presence of foreign military forces has created favorable conditions for terrorist activities within Syria. He said, "The unhindered movement of terrorist groups, including Daesh, into Syrian territory where foreign forces are illegally present, poses a serious threat to both regional and global peace and security." Iravani stated, "We support the legitimate demands of the Syrian government for the complete withdrawal of all illegal foreign military forces from Syrian territory." The U.S. regime deployed forces and military equipment in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorist group. Press TV reported. American forces have sustained their illegal presence on Syrian soil, although Damascus and its allies defeated Daesh in late 2019. Damascus maintains the deployment is meant to plunder the country's natural resources. The Iranian envoy also said the occupation of certain areas in the Arab country by illegal foreign forces, as well as the aggressions by the Zionist regime and terrorist groups, inflicted sustained suffering upon the Syrian people. Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations also added the Security Council must take a strong stance condemning such egregious violations and compelling the Israeli regime to cease its aggressions and put an end to the occupation of Syria and Golan. The Golan Heights have been under Israeli regime occupation since 1967, when the regime launched a large-scale war against the regional Arab states, including Syria. Tel Aviv regime has been using the territory as a launchpad for its acts of military aggression against the Arab nation ever since. Such attacks have intensified in recent months, despite the Syrian government's warnings. The Zionist regime has been also using the occupied territory to provide safe passage and medical treatment for the anti-Syria Takfiri terrorists, who would flee there from the Syrian military's counterterrorism operations. Recently, the Zionist regime launched airstrikes against the vicinity of the Syrian capital of Damascus, wounding a Syrian soldier and causing material damage in the area. Iravani said, "We strongly condemn the repeated aggressions and violations of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity by Israeli regime." He added, "These reprehensible acts, like the recent terrorist attacks on Damascus and its surrounding areas on August 21st, deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure, constitute a flagrant breach of international humanitarian law and the UN Charter. They also pose a grave threat to regional peace and stability."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It's just the kind of thing arms manufacturers want to hear. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky saying we are creating such a defense potential for Ukraine. His excitement was evident in this tweet, glorifying the military manufacturers, and that Ukraine is determining that. Finally, the truth is out in the open, normalizing war profiteering Zelensky style. And many would argue that was one of the goals of the U.S. in its proxy war with Russia. Except now, the Ukrainian president has turned Ukrainians into proxies of the military-industrial complex, as well as the Pentagon. Zelensky's sentiment was relayed while Kiev hosted 252, quote, defense industry corporations from 30 different countries. Zelensky urged the war profiteers to open factories in Ukraine to cut out the middleman. His speech included phrases like the defense industrial complex, arsenal of the free world, and a special economic regime for the defense industrial complex. Consider what the Ukrainian president is promoting. award to the military manufacturers to show prospective buyers and investors how various military equipment can rip apart human bodies in order to profit from death and destruction. These are the gruesome stats so far. Over 27,000 Ukrainian casualties. Meanwhile, Russia's military casualties have approached 300,000. The Russian numbers dwarf the Ukrainian figures, which officials put at close to 70,000 killed and between 100,000 to 120,000 wounded. Perhaps like no other time, the war in Ukraine, which Russia calls a special military operation, finds itself at a crossroads.
The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The U.S. Congress just passed an 11th-hour funding bill that excluded aid for Ukraine. This means the U.S. President's hands are tied in order to keep the aid flowing, at least for now. To make matters worse, the Pentagon has said that there's only $5.2 billion left to provide military support for Ukraine. Additionally, the account that the U.S. used for a long-term program to modernize the Ukrainian army and to increase its compatibility with NATO is empty. On the surface, that may sound like a bad thing, but if you think about it, that's great news. Maybe the war may come to an end soon. That, however, depends on who you ask. The EU foreign policy chief is not too happy about the U.S. turn of events.
Our support to Ukraine not only continues, but increases. Or at least, by the time being, the proposition on the table shows that we want to continue in increasing it. And to tell the truth, we were surprised by the fact that the last minute agreement has taken a decision that we have to regret deeply.
Europe is reluctant for this war to end. It has believed the U.S. line that Russia poses an existential threat to it. This is part of the reason why the U.K. has announced that it will send military instructors to the country. It will also transfer training and production of military equipment to Ukraine.
We stand shoulder with you. We feel your pain.
There is one important fact behind this announcement, which was made by the U.K. Defense Secretary. The important point, that the U.K. will send military instructors to Ukraine, all to happen on Ukrainian soil. There's an American saying that says, war is a racket. And the U.S.'s Big Five is very well aware of that. They are Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon, who split more than $150 billion in Pentagon contracts annually. That's nearly 20% of the total Pentagon budget. Ever since the Ukraine war began, they have reaped huge profits and in turn have contributed to the U.S. economy. Europe is following suit, and why shouldn't they? Their economies are not doing that well, and like the U.S., they want a piece of the pie. To manufacture weapons in Ukraine, in order to make up for some of the funds that they sent there. We mentioned the U.K. Germany's military manufacturer, Rheinmetall, has also announced that it will operate a maintenance plant in Ukraine. But Americans are angry. They want the support to stop.
It's the United States and NATO who are are to blame and the fundamental cause of the conflict in Ukraine, and that if we can force the U.S. government to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine, the war will end the very next day.
And in Germany, EU's powerhouse, things are pretty bad when doctors protest the high cost of living.
The clinics have no choice but to protest because we have to make sure we have money by the end of the month to pay all the staff and house rent.
Two-thirds being in the affirmative, the rules are suspended. The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
A U.S. government shutdown narrowly averted. This extension was more of a band-aid, since there's a strong possibility that lawmakers will find themselves battling it out in 45 days when the deadline arrives. However, what things the U.S. government spends its money on has been overlooked, which ironically should be the focus. Just take a look at these eye-popping figures. If there was a shutdown, soldiers would not get paid. And the ones on the bottom half of the social strata, especially ones getting government assistance and social services, would suffer. The government has averted a shutdown, but what about the wider U.S. economy? News making headlines in the U.S. are the auto workers' strike, which has expanded for the first time ever to include the Detroit Three. The union and the automakers remain far apart on key economic issues like pay.
We're not out here to grab headlines. You know, this isn't fun to us. We're not out here just for the heck of it. We're out here because GM and the three companies screwed around for over 7 weeks and didn't get into bargaining with us.
But the automakers did not reciprocate. Since 2013, they have raked in $250 billion in profits. That's $1.7 million that they made off each worker. Meanwhile, these are their CEO's salaries. Ford CEO Jim Farley, a modest $21 million per year. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares, $25 million per year. And General Motors CEO Mary Barra, who said she was extremely frustrated and disappointed by the strike, she makes $29 million per year. One automaker summed it up perfectly. I think people all around the country here are just getting fed up with the corporations not sharing or including them into the profit or acknowledging our hard work that we put into the company. The stats confirm that sentiment. Between 1979 and 2022, the inflation-adjusted annual wages of the top 1% of workers rose by 145%, while the average annual wages of the bottom 90% rose by only 16%. In the U.S., while the number of strikes is relatively unchanged, the number of striking workers has beat prior years. Some 362,000 workers have gone on a strike so far in 2023, compared with 36,600 over the same period 2 years ago. Job security should be a concern for Americans. Corporate bankruptcies have soared to a 13-year high. The workers on strike, like many other Americans, complain that their wages have not kept up with inflation. The official inflation rate in the U.S. for 2023 reported to be 3%, with the pay increase to have been 5%, outstripping inflation. But that does not match what the average American is facing when it comes to things like groceries, energy, transportation, travel, and dining. Just take a look at these figures in this table, showing the types of inflation that Americans faced in 2022. Although inflation has decreased in 2023, it is not the 5% that the U.S. government has announced across the board. Perhaps that is why the U.S. is experiencing an increase in poverty, which in 2022 was 12.4%. That's an increase of 4.6 percentage points from 2021. And in terms of food assistance, another shocking figure, 41.2 million Americans, 12.5% of the total U.S. population, received monthly SNAP benefits in the 2022 fiscal year. The U.S. makes around $6.3 trillion in income, and believe it or not, spends half of that amount on entitlement programs like food assistance and benefits. This does not sound like a very healthy economy. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000, equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affects health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe, and it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the Group of Seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting perhaps there are some quirks in the data, that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecasts predict, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers, but the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secret, because no one speak or no one report exactly what's going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
The chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, used a closely watched speech on Friday, 25th of August, to warn that the fight against inflation in the United States is not over. Jerome Powell said inflation was still too high and that interest rates may have to rise again to tamp it down. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell on Friday, 25th of August, called for more vigilance in the fight against inflation, warning that additional interest rate increases could yet to come. The central bank leader said inflation is still above where policymakers feel comfortable. Jerome Powell noted that the Federal Reserve will remain flexible as it contemplates further moves, but gave little indication that it's ready to start easing anytime soon. Jerome Powell said in a prepared remarks for his keynote address at the Kansas City Fed's annual retreat in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He said, although inflation has moved down from its peak, it remains too high. We are prepared to raise interest rates further if appropriate and intend to hold policy at a restrictive level until we are confident that inflation is moving sustainably down towards our objective. The speech resembled remarks Powell made last year at Jackson Hole, during which he warned that some pain was likely as the Federal Reserve continues its efforts to pull runaway inflation back down to its 2% goal. But inflation was running well ahead of its current pace back then. Regardless, Powell indicated it's too soon to declare victory, even with data this summer running largely in the Federal Reserve's favor. Jerome Powell acknowledged that risks are two-sided, with dangers of doing both too much and too little. He said doing too little could allow above-target inflation to become entrenched and ultimately require monetary policy to wring more persistent inflation from the economy at a high cost of employment. He added, doing too much could also do unnecessary harm to the economy. He noted, as is often the case, we are navigating by the stars under cloudy skies. Jerome Powell's remarks follow a series of 11 interest rate hikes that have pushed the U.S. Federal Reserve's key interest rate to a target range of 5.25% to 5.5%, its highest level in more than 22 years. In addition, the U.S. Federal Reserve has reduced its balance sheet to its lowest level in more than 2 years, a process which was seen about $960 billion worth of bonds roll off since June of 2022. Markets of late have been pricing in little chance of another hike at the September meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, but are pointing to about a 50-50 chance of a final increase at the November session. Projections released in June showed that almost all the Federal Open Market Committee officials saw another interest rate hike likely this year. Jerome Powell provided no clear indication of which way he sees the decision going. He said, given how far we have come, at upcoming meetings we are in a position to proceed carefully as we assess the incoming data and the evolving outlook and risks. However, he gave no sign that he's even considering an interest rate cut. Powell said, at upcoming meetings we will assess our progress based on the totality of the data and the evolving outlook and risks. He added, based on this assessment we will proceed carefully as we decide whether to tighten further or instead to hold the policy rate constant and await further data. The Federal Reserve Chairman added, economic growth may have to slow before the Fed can change course. Also, Powell noted the risk of strong economic growth in the face of widespread recession expectations and how that could make the Fed hold interest rates higher for longer. Jack McIntyre, portfolio manager at Brandywine Global, said it was a balanced but not trend-changing speech, even if the Federal Reserve kept the mission accomplished banner in the closet, adding, it leaves the Federal Reserve with needed optionality to either tighten more or keep interest rates on hold. While last year's speech was unusually brief, this time around, Jerome Powell provided a little more detail into the factors that would go into policymaking. Specifically, he broke inflation into three key metrics and said the Federal Reserve is most focused on core inflation, which excludes volatile food and energy prices. He also reiterated that the Federal Reserve most closely follows the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, a Commerce Department measure, rather than the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index, the CPI. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell used a closely watched speech on Friday, 25th of August, to warn that the fight against inflation in the United States is not over. Speaking at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City's annual gathering of central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Jerome Powell said inflation was still too high and that interest rates might have to rise further to tamp it down. Powell added that central bank will keep at it until the job is done. The U.S. Federal Reserve raised interest rates to a 22-year high in July, its 11th rate rise in 17 months. The annual rate of inflation has declined sharply, down from a 40-year high of 9% last June to close to 3%. But as the U.S. has rebounded from the pandemic and its aftermath, the economic picture has remained complicated for Powell. Consumer spending and the U.S. jobs market remains robust despite the sharp rise in interest rates. And while the headline rate of inflation has fallen, prices of food, housing, gas and other essentials remain far higher than they were before the pandemic. Jerome Powell has said that the Fed is aiming to achieve a soft landing for the economy, bringing down inflation without causing a sharp spike in job losses. But Powell has also acknowledged that the historically sharp increase in interest rates may not yet be reflected in the wider economy. Powell said Fed policymakers would proceed carefully as we decide whether to tighten further. His remarks showed the Fed wrestling with conflicting signals from an economic picture where inflation has, by some readings, slowed a lot without much cost to the economy, but one that has raised the possibility that Fed policy is not restrictive enough to complete the job. He said it was difficult to know with precision the degree to which the Fed's current 5.25% to 5.5% benchmark interest rate had cleared the neutral rate of interest needed to slow the economy, and therefore hard to assess just where policy stands. Powell repeated what has become a standard Fed diagnosis of inflation progress, with a pandemic-era jump in goods inflation easing and a decline in housing inflation in the pipeline, but concerned that continual consumer spending on a broad array of services and a tight labor market may make a return to 2% inflation difficult. The Federal Reserve Chairman said, given the size of the broader services sector, excluding housing, some further progress will be essential, and it will likely require an economic slowdown to deliver it. Powell said restrictive monetary policy will probably play an increasingly important role. Getting inflation sustainably back down to 2% is expected to require a period of below-trend economic growth, as well as some softening in labor market conditions. Powell added, 2% is and will remain our inflation target.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Baluchistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. We must pay careful attention to what is happening and know what we are doing. We should know what we are saying. The things we say should not help the enemy's scheme and help complete the enemy's puzzle. At times, a person may be neglectful. They may do something or say something that helps complete the enemy's puzzle and scheme. This is dangerous. We must be careful that this doesn't happen. If we are vigilant, the enemy will not be able to do a damn thing. During these 40-some years, today's enemies and the enemies that existed before but have ceased to exist, like the former Soviet Union, treated us badly and did whatever they could against us time and time again. The Iranian nation was awake. It was alert. It was following the objectives of Imam Khomeini. Imam's guidelines are valuable for us today as well. See what Imam was saying, what he wanted, and where he was leading us. The nation did this, and that is why it has succeeded up until now. The situation is the same today. We must be vigilant today as well.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemy has targeted two fundamental points. One is national unity and the other is national security. National unity is important. Do not let them destroy our unity. What is the meaning of unity? It means that with regard to the country's fundamental issues and in areas where the interests of the nations are at stake, religious differences, political differences, differences between groups and ethnic differences should be put aside. Everyone should be together. Different ethnic groups and different religions should be together. In places where there is a specific orientation, this unity is important. And with regard to security, those who threaten national security are the enemies of the nation. They work for the enemy, whether they realize this themselves or not. Sometimes they do things without realizing what they are doing. So, these two points are important. The enemy has targeted these two points, unity and security. We must confront it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done
choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Multipolar resistance seeks only the restoration of sovereign equality and the democracy between nations. The U.S. regime should learn to live with the multipolar world. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. China Daily wrote, "Today global politics is likely to display more uncertainty. Apart from the Russia-Ukraine crisis, the sense of the next Cold War felt by international society will continue to serve a specter around the world unless the U.S. endless endeavors to contain China in the Asia-Pacific stops. The U.S. containment strategies are revealed in the form of AUKUS and QUAD, as well as the U.S. relentless seduction of some countries, especially of Southeast Asia, to provoke China on the South China Sea issue and Taiwan. Desiring the aspirations and ideals of a harmonized world may end up in vain since global actors, notably the U.S., are unwilling to create conducive conditions. Without this, it seems impossible to make the peace of the world a reality, until the U.S. can live with the pluralistic world. Citing Mearsheimer, the U.S. must concede the differences in the political system as the natural tendency of the universality of life as democracy taught people to tolerate divergence." Therefore, to get hold of harmony in global politics, the U.S. has to take these bold actions. Above all, the U.S. must respect other countries' sovereignty. Without appreciating sovereignty, the state will lose its significance. To date and throughout history, the U.S. has often annoyed and breached other countries' territory. Such actions were exemplified by its invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, and many other countries. If respecting other sovereign integrity is not respected by the U.S., then any country at any time can be targeted by the U.S. Thus, the self-restraint of the U.S. to not encroach on other sovereignty is the pillar that could avoid wars. Otherwise, it leads to instability and uncertainty. In addition, the U.S. should become sober now, admitting that global politics now is fraught with emerging powers, where the U.S. mightiness alone is declining. Hence, the U.S. should accept its new fate of regression with sincerity and let another actor have the chance to play the role and contribute to the multipolar world. Egoistic and arrogant attitudes should be discarded by the U.S. The global order must be maintained and navigated together. Since the desire to create a fair order is not only China's vision, but also all nations, Kanti Bijapi and Ivan Lakosma show in their paper Asian Conceptions of International Order that all Asians want a voice in the construction and maintenance of international order, including India, Indonesia, and other Asian states. It should be noted that after becoming comfortable with the new form of multipolarity, surely the next step that the US should take is to discontinue its old-fashioned provocations, including its interventions in other countries. In the dynamic world, change is unavoidable. International society is not a stagnant state and is changing persistently. It is heading and moving forward, and no force can deny the phenomenon. The U.S. decline and others' rise is something that every state must be in the agreement with. The obstinacy of the U.S. in preserving its privilege to control and rule the world arbitrarily may lead the world increasingly shaky. In conclusion, the idea of the pillar of peace is dependent on the acceptance of the U.S. of its relative decline, where the U.S. must stop its provocation of other countries. The U.S. must stop its proxy war to merely satisfy its ambition. The U.S. must open up much more space to the role of the rising economies. And importantly, the U.S. must accede to live with the multipolar world. Global Times also wrote, unipolarity has had a very short life. It became U.S. doctrine only after the end of the Cold War, when, in 1992, George H.W. Bush's administration asserted in a strategy document that America's political and military mission in the post-Cold War era will be to ensure that no rival superpower is allowed to emerge. This claim to power is wedded to the ideology of liberalism. U.S. primacy was declared to be essential to the future of freedom. Unipolarity was a rollback of the equal sovereignty of all nations envisioned by the UN Charter. It replaced collective internationalism with U.S. unilateralism and international law with the so-called rules-based order, a vague euphemism for the super-sovereign status of the U.S. It is the U.S. that is the revisionist power relative to the post-World War international order, while it is the non-Western world that seeks a restriction of that order. The unipolar world era was hastened to its end, not by enemies, but by the recklessness of the neoconservative policy program. The neocons continue to drive U.S. policy. The economic vehicle of unipolarity, neoliberal globalization, collapsed in the global financial crisis of 2008 and has been sustained without reform by money printing and debt creation. Global manufacturing, trade, diplomacy, and culture are already multipolar. This year, Beijing has emerged as the center of global diplomacy. The U.S. cannot dominate Russia or China militarily, despite having surrounded them with military bases. Liberalism, the ideology of a unipolar empire, has lost the legitimacy it once had around the world. Western countries' internal and international response to the COVID crisis was a disappointment. Meanwhile, China's development has demonstrated that there are other non-Western routes to modernity. Permanent war and financialization have also eroded the internal legitimacy of the Western elite and its ideology. Trust in Western leaders and institutional media is at an all-time low. The rise of political populism is a sign that the liberalism that buttressed the empire's claim to primacy is no longer unipolar, even at home. Its rhetoric is worn, its ideology is exhausted, and its legitimacy is questioned. The world is already multipolar. The multipolarist effort to give it shape through institutional collaboration is practical, not ideological. It aims to build the practical ability to resist U.S. coercion. as the U.S. weaponizes every economic relationship, institution, instrument, and technology, it has become necessary for any state intent on preserving its sovereignty to find alternatives. The most abused of these dependencies is the dominance of the U.S. dollar.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Honoring slain journalist Shireen Abu Akla, the prominent Palestinian-American journalist who was assassinated by Israeli forces last year, women journalists came together in the northeastern city of Mashhad to send a strong message that women's full participation in public and political life is essential in addressing the multiple crises mankind is confronting in today's world. The International Khurshid Media Festival became the platform for these independent women journalists to share their experiences and thoughts on stories rarely covered by mainstream media. And some outstanding media reports were also awarded. The woman behind it all, American-Iranian broadcaster and Press TV host Marzia Hashemi, explains.
With this conference, what we're trying to do is to unite with perspectives from the alternative media and to try to expand, well, you know, our slogan at Press TV, being the voice of the voiceless, where we want to make sure that voice of the voiceless is getting louder and louder. And we're hoping with the cooperation with, we have people here from over 45 countries, that we can make it happen.
An important issue that was also highlighted by the Iranian president's wife, who was the keynote speaker at the panel discussion of the festival, as well as the president himself, who held a meeting with the visiting journalists.
In different arenas in this media war, where there are different versions of the same stories, it is important to give voice to journalists who are telling the true stories. In many cases, strong and brave women are doing exactly that.
And the participants are already on board.
Just as Mrs. Alam Al Huda, the president's wife, explained today, we live in a world where there is a hegemony on news, and certain news outlets tell the entire world what the problems are and what the solutions should be. And that has become a norm.
In this venue, you know, we have a situation where we can hear the voices of the voiceless from around the world, basically. We have people from Latin America, we have people from Africa, from Asia, from America. So here it's a good opportunity to start a project that can break that norm, basically, that colonialized norm. We are looking forward to a new future.
Met with the support of a huge number of independent journalists, the Secretariat announced that this festival will be held every 2 years.
The Khurshid Media Festival is an effort to bring together women journalists from across the world to cover important issues and to give a voice to voices that have been muffled by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Mashhad.
In the past few presidential elections, the number one voter demand has been to address housing issues, which are suffered by one out of every four people in France. Many consider the European refugee crisis to be in its eighth year, adding to the national housing policy failure. The failure of Western sanctions on Russia has helped rent to explode over the last year by over 7%.